I am speaking to you at a moment of grave crisis.
I'm Jeff Turner, and this is Recall. It's a series about history. Not the ancient past, but history that's still hot to the touch. In this first season, I explore a revolutionary political movement that brought a modern democracy to the brink. You can find Recall, How to Start a Revolution, on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hi, I'm Pia Chattopadhyay. Welcome to the Sunday Magazine podcast, featuring the stories we first brought you Sunday, April 7th on CBC Radio. Federal Liberals make pre-budget promises and the Foreign Interference Inquiry ramps up. Our Sunday politics panel is here first up to tackle it all. After that, envy and jealousy, ethics and morals, tyrant and fascist. You may use some of these terms interchangeably, but as we'll hear, there's great value to be gleaned from language's fine distinctions. We'll also examine the growing threats facing aid workers in Gaza after Israeli strikes killed 7 members of the World Central Kitchen this past week. Then, later on, it is time for us all to put our brains to the test as we play another round of That's Puzzling. And we will close it out with the CBC's Bob McDonald on why the moon blocking out the sun during tomorrow's solar eclipse is so much more than just a visual treat. It all starts right now on the Sunday Magazine. It's budget time once again in Canada. Next week, the federal government will lay out its economic blueprint for our country. But you may have already heard about some of the big ticket items on the agenda as the Liberals keep making pre-budget announcements. A renter's bill of rights and a $6 billion housing plan, hoping it might win back those voters that have been drifting to the Conservative Party. Meanwhile, the ongoing investigation into foreign interference in our elections is heating up, with Prime Minister Justin Trudeau set to testify in the next couple of days before the commission. So, no better time to convene our Sunday politics panel. Susan Delacourt is a national columnist with the Toronto Star. Matt Gurney is a SiriusXM host as well as the co-founder of The Line on Substack. Hi, Susan. Hi, Matt.
Hi, Bill.
Good morning.
Hi, Matt.
Let's start with the kind of pre-budget announcements that have been being unveiled over the last number of days and weeks. Governments are usually much more tight-lipped about their plans in the lead-up to the budget. Are all these pre-budget announcements this time around a good strategy for the Liberals?
I'd say yes. I'd love your other guest on fine distinctions to weigh in on this one. Because when is it? Is it still a budget if it's been released already? Or is it an election campaign? And I know Matt Galloway asked the Prime Minister that on The Current. Have we started an election and we just aren't aware of that yet? I do think, though, one of the complaints that Liberals will say increasingly publicly is that people aren't aware enough of what the Liberals' legacy is or what some of their achievements are. And I think this was an idea to get them out there and talking about the budget. We all know, normally, I'm one of the guilty ones. You cover the budget one day and 2 days later, nobody's talking about it. And this is 3 weeks of budget announcements. And I think never mind the voters the Liberals are looking to get, I think for Liberals themselves, it's a bit of a shot in the arm, that it's given the MPs something to talk about out there other than is Trudeau going or is Poilievre the next prime minister.
And so, Matt, Susan makes a case that this might be a good strategy for the Liberals. Are there drawbacks, as you see it, though, to them being so public with their ideas ahead of the actual budget?
I mean, of course there are. I think on balance, I do agree with Susan. And I would just add to what Susan said. Also, with the foreign interference inquiry going on, and I know we'll mostly talk about that later. I know we've carved out some time for that in particular. It gives them a little bit of a channel changer if anything bad comes out. If there's any testimony they don't want to dwell on, well, hey, check out our housing announcement today. So there's a bit of a strategic purpose to it there as well. But no, and Pia, to your question, sure. I mean, every idea that gets put out there can now be attacked on the merits, or it can even be attacked unfairly on the merits if the opposition parties so choose. So there's always risk putting an idea out there into the political marketplace, so to speak. But overall, yeah, I think I agree. I mean, I think for a couple of months, the Liberals have needed something to talk about other than caucus divisions over the war in the Middle East or the prime minister's future or Pierre Poilievre's approval ratings and all these things. Getting out there and talking about feeding kids, I mean, protecting renters. These are more popular things. One of the things I would also just note, and I think Susan would have noticed this as well, the prime minister is not just sort of announcing these policies or having his proxies announce these policies. He's also thrown a punch or two at some of the premiers here. And I think that is deliberate too. So this is all part of, I think, a pre-budget messaging campaign for sure. But I also think it's just all a bigger effort to try to give the Liberals a little bit of fight back. They've been having kind of a rough few months. Maybe now they get to go on the offensive a bit.
Okay, Susan, so let's pick up on the risk part of this that Matt was sort of outlining there. And when I was listening to there, the thing that he brought up about this tension between the federal and provincial governments, this is particularly around housing and housing affordability, which, of course, is a big issue across this country. The Liberals say they're going to pour, you know, billions of dollars into kickstarting home building to deal with the issue. This proposal has caused already tension between the federal and provincial governments. So is that a risk? What's the rub here?
Well, you know, this is a prime minister who does have to deal with the premiers. And I agree with Matt. He's been throwing some punches. He more or less in Toronto the other day with standing there with Olivia Chow, Doug Ford, his erstwhile pal, nowhere in sight. And he said, if Ford's government isn't going to step up on housing to our liking, we're just going to go over their heads and make announcements here with mayors like Olivia Chow. It does, you know, those with long memories will remember his dad going over the heads of provinces too on the Constitution. To the tone, not just with the provinces, I think there's been I know Matt wrote about this week too. The chippy, aggressive tone from the prime minister has been noteworthy this week. Definitely.
Chippy. Okay, let's stick with that word, chippy, because, you know, it's not just a tension with the premiers over housing. It's also the carbon tax is also the backdrop leading up to this as well. There's been big divisions there. And the prime minister has not minced his words on where he stands in terms of what the premiers are saying on that issue as well. So, Matt, is this a new era, a new aggressiveness in how Prime Minister Trudeau takes on the leader of the opposition, the premiers? Like, is this a shift? And if so, do you see thus far it being an effective shift?
Oh, boy. I mean, those are two very separate questions, aren't they?
Great.
I mean, is there a shift? Is there a shift? I think, yeah, right now there is. What the open question I have on whether or not it's a shift is whether or not this is going to fade after the budget. And I know this is Canada, so I know even mentioning this is tempting fate, but we are going to be heading into the nicer weather. Now, having said that, I think we've probably condemned us all to a blizzard or something, but like the good weather isn't that far away. Barbecue season isn't that far away. So there's a kind of a limited window of time here for this shift to play out before everybody goes home anyway. So we'll see if they sustain this all the way over to the summer or if this is really just a pre-budget thing. To your question, though, about whether it's going to work, I just honestly don't know, because I agree with Susan's analysis, what she said a minute ago of there being frustration among Liberals that they're not getting credit for the things that they've either done or the things that they've proposed. And that going out and picking fights with the premiers can be a way of kind of sharpening the distinction between the two. And also, I know that there is frustration among the federal Liberals with the sense that they get blamed for things that provincial premiers have screwed up. So I think they do want to get out there and have those fights. But as one of my buddies told me many, many years ago, whenever you're starting any kind of fight, remember that the other guy has a plan too. So don't get so absorbed in your plan that you forget that there's going to be 10 premiers and three territorial leaders who might not want to spend the next few months being the prime minister's punching bag, and they can fight back too here. So will it work? I don't know. And a lot of it, I mean, this government, like as one conservative operative told me this week, he actually had said, I think they're finding their grit again. They're finding their fight again. They're actually going to be able to dig in and throw some punches here. But he says these guys have had the worst luck. And he didn't mean that in a critical way. He was just sort of saying they've had to deal with Trump. They've had to deal with a pandemic. They've had to deal with a convoy. He says every time they try to get their feet under them, something goes terribly wrong. And he said the foreign interference inquiry for this government is a Rumsfeldian unknown unknown. They don't know what they don't know.
We'll talk about the inquiry just a sec. But Susan, you know, you've covered the prime minister for a long time. I know you and others have sort of often written about he likes kind of being this underdog and this sort of fighter, like that sort of as a person and as a politician, he likes and enjoys being in that position. We do have, of course, in the official opposition leader, also someone who's likes to take the fight, too. So, you know, we've been talking about sort of the tensions between the provinces and the federal government. But how much of this chippiness, as you put it, of Justin Trudeau is to, you know, square off against his main opponent in Pierre Poilievre?
Oh, I think we're going to see that this week. You know, the prime minister, the big marquee appearance will be the foreign interference inquiry. But we are going to see it. I think we've already seen it in the House of Commons. I can't say I enjoy it. I don't know that other Canadians, what they think when they see two leaders sort of yelling at each other all the time. But I do definitely think it's in response to Poilievre and not just where he's standing in the polls, but the whole aggressive tone of Poilievre, very personal. I'm not going to say it gets under their skin, but I think you can see the irritation. I've had other cabinet ministers tell me, too, that they've had it up to here with Poilievre, and, you know, walking all over them. So I think, you know, all of us would love to be a fly on the wall of caucus, or maybe just political junkies like me. But I would love to know what they're saying behind the scenes about how they want to take him on.
One of the demographics that the Liberals want to and arguably need to get on side, because they've had them in the past and have lost a lot of them, are young voters. And Susan, you know, you talk about tone. As Liberals try and win back young voters, I guess I'm asking you to be a bit stereotypical here in the sense that we're going to try and throw a whole demographic in. But like, do you think that's a good approach for sort of the demographics Liberals are going after?
Well, they've got to get those voters back. You know, if not them, they're going to do it, I think, two ways. One, on climate. I think they're going to encourage those voters, look, you know, it's more young people than older folks are worried about climate and Mr. Poilievre's plan. So I think they're going to do it that way. And the prime minister is not even making it subtle. He's out there saying, I had those voters in 2015. I want them back. And I'm going to talk about fairness. I'm going to talk about their sense that things are very unfair right now. Sort of an echo of Poilievre saying Canada's broken. But the world doesn't feel fair to you right now, and we're going to try to make it more fair. That's I expect, I don't know the title of the next budget, but I wouldn't be surprised if fairness was in it.
It is not lost on me that we have three middle-aged people talking about the young people right now. But let's just get you to weigh in on this. As Liberals try and draw them either back or to their party, is the tone and are the policy announcements, which many have said are, you know, are geared towards young voters, do you see them working?
No, is I guess the easy answer. I mean, I think they will probably start to fix what has been one major problem for the Liberals over the last year. In some cases, we could even, if we wanted to, we could say a year and a half. And I'd written a column about this. Poilievre had been the only guy out there talking about some of these problems for a while. I mean, there'd been academic experts saying, wow, like these metrics are really indicating a massive cost of living problem for some segments of the demographic. But the Liberals, I mean, as recently as the last summer, were not engaging with housing and cost of living with the seriousness that they should have been. And I think that was just killing them. And I think it gave Paul Heath like a completely uncontested field where he could go and claim that. So it is going to help them, the liberals, I should say, to go out there and to start contesting that ground, to try and say, look, we're not going to let you take this without a fight from us. And at least now they are messaging on these key issues where Polyev was dominating almost unopposed for months. But in terms of the amount of damage done, and this is something I've spoken with both liberals and conservatives about, I'm looking at all of the things they're messaging, all of the things they're announcing, all of the things they're promising, and I'm trying to figure out what is the best possible time frame where they could execute some of this stuff. And some people might be swayed by the message alone. I'm not going to say that's going to be zero voters out there. But even if we go maximum speed here, we are likely only going to get some of this stuff rolling out just in time for Pierre Poilievre's re-election campaign.
Okay, let's talk about this foreign interference commission that is going on. Matt, it wasn't so long ago, you know, that there were so many stories in the press about how foreign bad actors were messing in our politics. And this commission investigating foreign interference into our past federal elections really heated up. I think over this past week, we had a lot of high-level government officials testifying, and we had former Federal Conservative Party leader Aaron O'Toole, who testified on Wednesday. And just to sort of sum up what he said, he told the Inquirer that he believes the Chinese government interference may have cost his party, the Conservatives, between 5 and 9 seats in the 2021 federal election. He did say it didn't overturn the overall or didn't impact the overall result. And he also said that the relevant authorities should have and could have given more information about what was going on. Matt, let me start with you because I know you wrote about this and it was on, you and Jen Gerson talked about it this week as well. How do you assess what Aaron O'Toole told the commission?
Well, I think I can't assess his information, right? Because what he is alleging, and this is important, is he is alleging that Conservative Party predictive modeling for the 2021 election was fantastically accurate with a couple of really notable exceptions. And their model completely missed trends in ridings and those in a few ridings. And those ridings are the ones where we believe kind of or CSIS has concluded that there might have been foreign interference. So Aaron O'Toole is pointing to the wild swings in the otherwise very accurate conservative model, pardon me, and saying that must be caused to foreign interference. Let's be clear. That's not necessarily the case. There may have been other things. There may have been other things. And I guess we'll see in coming days, especially as more government officials testify, including the prime minister, I believe, testifying next week as well. We'll learn more about that. But the one thing he did say that I do think is new, and I think we now have new information that will at the very least be strongly supportive of this, is that I think he is right that the institutions, the apparatuses we put in place to safeguard our elections probably did not communicate effectively with the parties here. And this has been a recurring theme that Susan and I have talked about with you, Pia. This is not only is this a recurring theme, it's a recurring theme for the three of us. Like, the government compartmentalization of information, particularly intelligence information, and the ability of government to share information it has across itself, particularly during time-sensitive crises, is abysmal. And I think we've learned that during the convoy. We've seen other examples during the pandemic. And I get the feeling that the Foreign Interference Commission is going to be another example of, I don't know how many seats got swung away from the conservatives, if any, but it definitely looks like the federal government knew more than it was willing to share. And that seems to be a recurring problem we really need to fix.
Susan, I'll come to you in a minute, but I just want to stick with you, Matt, because you also wrote a couple of days ago about when you were writing about the O'Toole testimony, about the prime minister's response to it, because the prime minister was asked, I think it was the same day, about what he thought about that. You had things to say about how the prime minister responded. I don't want you to tell us everything you said, but what's your issue with that?
Well, Pia, I was planning on simply reading my column. I was going to do a live reading.
We're only a two-hour show, Matt.
Yeah. Aaron O'Toole gave the testimony in line with what we've already said there. And the prime minister was asked about it at one of his, 38,000 housing announcements last week, I think it was. And he said that he can understand why a guy like Aaron O'Toole, who lost an election, wanted to find someone to blame for losing that election. And I had two big takeaways from that comment. First of all, for the prime minister, who normally, with all credit to him, normally tries to elevate the debate in his public comments, normally tries to be classy in his public comments. I thought that was a notably petty comment from him. And I thought that was surprising, only if it was out of character. But I also think, you know, as I wrote in the column, if the prime minister wants to open the door to speculating about how emotional motives might be interfering with how elected leaders deal with the prospect of foreign interference, I think we have to note on the record that the prime minister and his party have done everything in their power to stonewall the investigations into foreign interference. They, like, you know, first they denied it was a problem. The prime minister said it was anti-Asian racism to even talk about it. And then we had liberals filibustering the committees for weeks. And then we had the Johnston report, which did not end up pleasing anyone. And only then did we get the foreign interference inquiry. And my point in the column was, if Mr. Trudeau wants to speculate that Mr. O'Toole is convinced foreign interference is a problem because of his ego, we have to then speculate if Mr. Trudeau, the winner of the election, doesn't want to admit it might have been a factor because of his ego.
Hmm. Susan, you've been sitting there. I know you got things to say on this one. So let loose, my friend.
I was going to read Matt's column out loud, too, if you don't mind.
A rebuttal. Maybe a rebuttal, Susan.
We'll all get a chance to read it together.
Fair comment from Matt. I think the one thing I think liberals would say is they have been taking this seriously. They're the ones who set up the very panel that has been, you know, rightly accused and appropriately accused of not telling people like Aaron O'Toole or the parties enough. We saw the testimony this week from the senior party officials saying, you know, the briefings we got on foreign interference or were kind of generic and bland. And the government's own watchdog or Morris Rosenberg wrote a report on this a good year ago, I believe, saying we've got to have a higher or lower threshold for informing parties about what's going on there. I think that's been established. I think I was always a fan of a public inquiry, not because you know, some of this stuff needed to be aired, which it did. I think citizens really need to know and be reassured that our elections are free and fair, especially given what's going to be happening in the United States later this year. I think, you know, I don't know how we're going to watch that spectacle and not have some doubts about our own election. So I think this is a good exercise, a sort of a preemptive one but it does, you know, it also plants some doubts. We're learning things in this inquiry that we didn't know about foreign, you know, the Pakistan government's involvement, for example. So I'm trying to keep my eye on the ball in this inquiry on what its purpose should be, is to make citizens have confidence in, you know, the basic democracy and the basic way we choose government in this country.
Okay, I don't have a ton of time, but I do want to ask you about the comings and goings of politicians. We saw Liberal MP Anthony Housefather on Friday saying he's going to stay a member of the Liberal caucus. Many people thought he might bolt after the Liberals backed a motion saying it would work towards the establishing a state of Palestine and halting arms exports to Israel. We also saw late last week that three veteran NDP MPs announced they're not going to run in the next election, including Charlie Angus, high profile. I think it's about nearly a quarter of the NDP caucus have said that they're going to leave or have already done so. So, Susan, just with a couple of minutes that we have left, the comings and goings, I know this is all like we're going to talk about an election for the next year until it happens, unless it happens before that. But like, what are we seeing sort of the map changing? What is that saying to you?
Actually, I can draw a line between the foreign interference inquiry and this, because one of the bits of testimony we saw this week was from the RCMP or CSIS, I believe, saying how dangerous it is becoming to be a politician. And Charlie Angus has spoken about this, one of the retiring NDP MPs. I'm worried myself about, you know, the growing threat environment, the way that politics is being conducted, and I can't consider that separate from this exodus. You know, I am worried about how the next election is going to unroll.
Matt, we'll give you the last word on this, about the comings and goings and what it might suggest.
You know what? Look, it's always hard to draw an aggregate conclusion from what is ultimately, for all of these people, an individual decision. They've all got family considerations. I agree with Susan. There's the simple decline in the quality of life for a politician that needs to be factored in. But I will say, broadly speaking, one of the things I am noticing, and I'm noticing it right across what we could call the political economy. So it's politicians, it's communication guys, it's pollsters, it's strategists. The market seems to be pricing in a conservative victory. And I think we're going to see a lot of people who might want to try to get those conservative nominations because they think that's going to mean 4 years in government. And we might see people, in the Liberal and NDP caucuses deciding maybe now is a time to go think about other careers and spend more time with the kids.
Okay. We will have a live reading of Matt's latest column at a date yet to be determined, but for now we'll leave it there. Thank you both, as always.
Thanks,
guys. Susan Delacourt is a national columnist with the Toronto Star. Matt Gurney is a SiriusXM host and co-founder of The Line on Substack. So on many a Sunday, you may be listening to our show lounging on your couch with a warm latte. Or wait, is that a sofa you're sitting on? And is that beverage in your hand actually a flat white? The differences between these kinds of terms may seem small, but Eli Bernstein says there is greater meaning behind the distinctions we make in everyday life. Eli is a Canadian humor writer, also a human writer, spelling bee host, and author of a new book called The Dictionary of Fine Distinctions. In it, he clarifies the subtle differences between common things, everything from the type of coffee you're drinking to the philosophical debate over what is ethical versus what is moral. And Eli's here in our latest installment of Word Processing, our ongoing look at language. Eli, good morning.
Good morning.
So the most difficult question I'm going to ask you is, if I were sitting in my home on a long piece of furniture, because we're in chairs here, is my cozy lounger a couch or a sofa?
How comfortable is it?
Mine's not that comfortable. It has arms.
But you did say cozy.
Cozy, yeah. Or are you going to take umbrage with cozy and comfortable or sofa and couch?
No, I was just going to say that the difference in connotation is that couch tends to suggest a comfy, casual lounger. So the words you used struck me as a couch, whereas a sofa suggests something more elegant and upright. But then you said it wasn't that comfortable. So now I'm not so sure.
Okay, let's just clear this up once and for all. Is it a couch or a sofa? The thing that people have in their living rooms that have like three seats. So it's not a love seat, adjoining three seats. Is it a couch or a sofa? What's right?
Do you watch TV on it?
Oh, God. Yes.
I'm going to say it's a couch. I think a couch is really for lounging and being cozy and comfortable, just as you said. A sofa is a little more elegant, more upright, more formal. But ultimately, these are very faint connotations. And this is one of those cases where the words are almost interchangeable.
Okay, acceptably interchangeable.
Acceptably interchangeable, absolutely.
Okay, so that's fine that I can interchange those two. But what about coffees? Like, I know the difference between latte and flat white, but we're picky about this stuff. When we go to our coffee shop, we have to tell them how much milk we want in our drink. So that's important. But like, how important are these distinctions?
Yeah, well, I guess it does depend who you ask and how much you love your coffee and how much milk you want in your coffee. But the difference between a latte and a flat white, really the difference we should be talking about is between a flat white and a cappuccino.
Okay.
Because a latte is going to be bigger than the other two.
Tons of milk, small amount of espresso.
That's right. Just to clear that one off. So it's going to be bigger than the other two, more milk, weaker flavor. A cappuccino and a flat white, on the other hand, are closer together because they're often the same size, if not the exact same size. And so where the difference comes in there is that cappuccinos are often going to be more aerated, or what baristas refer to as stretched. They're going to be more stretched. So that means there's more air in it, which coffee aficionados describe as tasting a bit fluffier, whereas the flat white has what's commonly described as a more velvety texture. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so, and this is important, that first example of couch sofa versus the second example of flat white cappuccino. The distinction between those two is that if I say, hey, can I sit on your nice couch? It doesn't really matter. This is a nice sofa, whatever. But if I go to the coffee store and order a flat white when I really mean a cappuccino, I'm getting the wrong drink.
That's right. The stakes vary widely from one entry to the next, and depending on who you're talking to. If you were in a furniture store, for instance, and you said you're looking for a couch or a sofa, they might lead you to a different section.
Oh, fair enough. Okay. You have titled this book, The Dictionary of Fine Distinctions, not just distinctions. So here's a meta question for you. What's the difference between a fine distinction and a regular one?
A fine distinction is any distinction that you're liable to get confused about, or that you weren't even aware was a distinction in the first place. So the first example, or an example of the first kind, might be the difference between Great Britain and the United Kingdom. So for many people, myself included, we have a sense that there's a difference, but if we're being brutally honest with ourselves, we don't 100% remember what that difference is. Maybe I'm in the minority here.
Don't cross the pond and say that. Yeah.
Yeah, no, exactly. But there is a difference. We just tend to muddle it, and we know that there is a difference. The second category, a good example, might be ethics versus morality. So in that case, I personally had no idea there was a difference. I was curious, I looked into it, and lo and behold, there was.
Okay, hold up. We'll get to that one in a second. But I want to go back to Great Britain and the United Kingdom. Do you know what the difference between the United Kingdom and Great Britain is now?
I do now, yes, and I hope that I don't forget it.
Okay, so tell the audience.
You bet. So Great Britain is a geographical term referring to a single island or landmass, whereas the United Kingdom is a political term that refers to the countries, or to the regions England, Scotland, Wales, which collectively make up Great Britain, plus Northern Ireland, which is on a separate landmass known as Ireland.
Yes, very good. You pass. Okay, so when you hear people talking all the time, I'm sure you're like, oh, that's the wrong term. Like, that's what happens to you when you write a book like this. It's like, oh, that's the wrong one. Tell me some of the more common mistakes beyond those two that you gave that you've noticed that you want people to kind of understand. Look, there is a distinction here. We'll get to morality and ethics, or morals and ethics, in a second, but give us a couple more.
You raise an interesting topic, which is my goal in the book is not as much to correct people or...
Tisk tisk.
I mean, I know that there's probably a bit of that vibe in there inevitably, but it's less to correct people about kind of when to use which word and more to, I guess, cultivate an appreciation for all the nuances that are out there, right? So for us to just appreciate all the different meanings there are in life. So to take an example, assume and presume might be a good example of this, where, you know, to assume is to suppose something without evidence, whereas to presume is to suppose something with confidence because there's a little bit of evidence, as in the expression presumed dead. Normally, if someone is missing, presumed dead, it's because there's pretty strong inferential support to suggest that they are dead.
That's like presumed innocent. But you're supposed to be innocent.
Well, actually, this is what makes language so messy, is that the presumption of innocence in a legal setting has a slightly different meaning, and I wrestled with that for so long. But here's the thing. So for me, it's not about, you know, wagging my finger and saying, hey, use the right word here, you know, use the right word in all contexts, or else we're all going to be confused and you don't speak English properly, etc. It's not about that. It's more about, I hope, going, huh, look, there are two human behaviors that we engage in. One we call assuming and one we call presuming. And whether we know it at a conscious level or not, there is something that we're doing when we engage with others that's so slightly different. And it's amazing that language can track those different behaviors.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk about two other groupings, because I think these are ones that people mix up all the time. And I want you to tell us what the distinctions, the fine distinction is. So let's start with the one we've referenced, ethics and morality. Or yeah. Ethics and morals, I should be more clear about
yeah,
that.
Yeah, so ethics and morals, or morality. So they are so similar, but ethics tends to refer to kind of explicit principles of right and wrong, whereas morality tends to suggest or convey right and wrong as a felt sense. So to use some kind of classic phrases in English, we might talk about workplace ethics or a code of ethics where principles of right and wrong have been formulated and made explicit. Whereas with morality, we might talk about a moral compass or moral fiber. So it tends to invoke, you know, the conscience, perhaps one's relationship with their faith or an authority figure like their parents. There's just that subtle difference in connotation.
One's more subjective than the other? What do you say, morals are more subjective?
I mean, this was so hard because I think for a while I was tempted to say that, but I think that one is more a matter of the head and the other is more a matter of the heart. So I think that they both have a reality in human discourse and in human life, but ethics is more cerebral. And I think a good example of that is in philosophy departments, there's no morality class, but there is an ethics class, right? Because in philosophy, you're interested in kind of making questions of right and wrong explicit. We're talking about it in rational and conceptual terms. Whereas morality is, like I say, more a matter of the heart, more a matter of instinct, but still has force and reality. So I would say it's subjective, but also interpersonal and social.
Okay, here's the other one I want you to clear the air about. Envy and jealousy, or envious and jealous?
Yes. So envy is when you want something that someone else has. Jealousy is when you don't want others to have something that you do.
Oh, okay.
Now, to muddy the waters a bit.
You're like the worst dictionary.
That's right. I mean, dictionaries, I'm sure if you talk to professional lexicographers, they'll tell you how difficult it must be, you know, to be accurate in such a small space without sacrificing nuance. Inevitably, you have to sacrifice some, but to preserve as much of the meaning of a word in a couple lines. Yeah, so, you know, the word jealousy, despite this difference that we started with, the word jealousy can be used to mean envious and has a centuries-long record of doing so. So you can't, it doesn't go both ways. You can't, you know, an envious boyfriend or a girlfriend or a partner, that doesn't really make sense. You have a jealous partner, you don't have an envious partner, and that doesn't mean the same thing. But if you told me you were going to Greece next week, I could say jealous. Or I could say, oh, I'm envious,
yeah,
right?
Okay.
And in that context, they do mean the same thing. So it's not a two-way street. And that's the beautiful messiness of the English language.
Okay. So look, you said, look, I'm not here to tiss people. Fair enough. And thank you for it. But why is it important to know these subtle differences between various words when they are similar, and at least by common usage, we interchange them?
It's, I think, a joy in its own right to have a sharper grasp of the meanings of words. But I think having a sharper grasp of what these words mean can help improve the quality of debate. And I think it can do that in a couple ways. So first, I think it can arm you against abuses of language by others, against rhetoric. So if somebody says, oh, you know, hey, I don't like that politician, I think that they're a fascist. If you have a strong sense of what these words mean, it allows you to go, are they a fascist? I don't know. So I think you're less vulnerable to the kind of manipulative force.
And hyperbole.
Yes, I think hyperbole is a rhetorical device, or it can be used as a rhetorical device. And it can kind of manipulating you into thinking or believing things if you're not on your guard. So I think that's one half. I think the other half, which is a bit more positive, is I think trying to use the words in a way that's true to their meaning, I think it helps us get back to a kind of common space and a shared linguistic reality, and ultimately a shared reality. Like, okay, maybe they're not a fascist, but maybe we can find accurate terms to describe what they are and get on the same page about that, and maybe have a closer and more meaningful debate about it.
And these fine distinctions, one would argue, and you might argue, that in this time of misinformation, but more importantly in this context, disinformation, where people are trying to deliberately mislead you by playing with language and trying to sneak one past the goalie, that's really important that we understand these things.
Yeah, I think that's very well put.
You got to add to that.
Oh, I mean, you said it so well. Like you said, being on your guard against not just accidental, but willful misuses and abuses of language is the kind of first step. And then the other step is, I think that if we use words trying to be accurate in our descriptions, we can start to be speaking in the same language, right? We're on the same page. We can have more meaningful debates as opposed to simply talking past one another in our echo chambers.
Okay, so that's like, there's the not well-intentioned humans that use this for disinformation, and then just us having a better understanding of precisely and accurately what we're talking about. What do you do, though, in the case where I screwed up latte with flat white, or I call your couch a sofa, or vice versa? I don't remember which one's which anymore. But how do you approach that? Because people don't like being, you know, having a finger wagged at them saying, you used the wrong words.
You have to take it on a case-by-case basis. Maybe that's a cop-out of an answer, but I try not to correct people. Maybe that's rich coming from someone who just wrote a book that's arguably a 100.
Here, read my book.
Yeah, 100. Yeah, I just get passive-aggressive about it and write a book and tell everyone to read it. No, I think that, you know, to correct someone, I think, is an intimate thing to do. And if you have that kind of relationship or friendship, then by all means, I, for instance, welcome those corrections.
Yeah, they're fun to learn.
Yeah, yeah. Believe it or not, I'm a little bit of a nerd about these things. So I like to be corrected most of the time, I guess. But yeah, I think that if you do it tactfully, if you know your audience, but generally speaking, I tend not to. I think that, you know, if it's a coworker, my employer, an acquaintance, I'm not going to say, oh, you should have said whom there. Because if you understand what they're trying to say, then communication is happening.
So we, of course, have regionalisms and then national distinctions. So let me bring up the most Canadian one. Eli, just so you know, in case you don't know, I'm from Saskatchewan. And I grew up there and lived there for the first 22 years of my life. And I never went to a cottage, though I went to many cabins. Then I moved to Ontario and everyone's like, I'm going to the cottage for the weekend. I'm like, what the heck is that? And where is this cottage thing you speak of? So let us talk about cabin and cottage. We have done actually our own deep dive into this one before. But you left this one out of your book deliberately.
Every omission was deliberate. No. And that's actually a great one. But it is true that readers will notice that I don't have a lot of regionalisms in the book. And I think that's because I was ultimately interested in differences in meaning rather than differences in where different words are used to refer to the same thing.
Like bunny hug and hoodie. Same thing, just regional.
Exactly. Well, that's actually a new one to me. What was that?
Okay, bunny. You've never heard bunny hug?
No.
Oh, in Saskatchewan and parts of Alberta. Alberta, don't get mad at me. I'm just claiming this is completely Saskatchewan. A sweatshirt with a hood on it that you pull over, not a zip up, we call a bunny hug.
That's adorable.
I know. It's amazing. Why I never call them hoodies, because why would you say hoodie when you could say bunny hug?
That's great. Yeah, I mean, and a kind of common one that you hear, in the U.S. or in across North America is pop versus soda, right? And then in some narrow regions of the U.S., they still say Coke to refer to all pops or sodas, believe it or not. But ultimately, that didn't qualify as a fine distinction for me because they all refer to the same thing. So the meaning is the same and the difference is more on the surface. And it's actually the same reason why in the book I tended also not to include a lot of homonyms. So words that may sound alike or look alike and are commonly confused for that reason. So there, and there, or it's and it's, or illicit and illicit. The list goes on, right? And those are totally interesting in their own right, but their affinities are on the surface. The words, the meanings that they refer to are actually so different that they don't really qualify to me as a fine distinction.
What was your favorite? Like, as you're researching for this book, I'm sure you have so many. We could be here for hours. But like, what? You've got a list, don't you? You have a list of your favorites.
Yeah, I think I do. I have a soft spot for Maze and Labyrinth.
Oh!
I thought that was interesting to me because as a kid, like probably so many kids, I loved mazes. I loved books of mazes. And all my life until very recently had no idea that a labyrinth was something else.
Okay, wait. Because all your life until right now, I thought these two things were the same. So you're saying they're not?
They are not.
That's the sound of Pia's mind being blown.
Excellent. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to talk over that. Can we hear the whoosh again? Perfect. So, and we'll muddy the waters in a second, I know, frustratingly. And trust me, no one's more frustrated than me to have all these beautiful edges then become blurred. But a maze is a multi-pathed puzzle. It has multiple paths, or what experts called is multi-cursal, and it is riddled with dead ends, and the challenge is to find the exit or occasionally the center, right? So it is a game, it is a puzzle.
Yeah, that drawing thing we all did as kids.
Yeah, we're all familiar with that. A labyrinth is unicursal or single-pathed. There are no dead ends. There are no forking paths. It is a single track that winds in a spiral-like formation, sometimes doubling back on itself in various patterns, and it leads you toward the center. And the goal there is not to challenge you or challenge your navigation skills, but to calm down the mind. So a labyrinth actually has a therapeutic or contemplative effect, and actually has a millennia-old history in various religions as kind of being a sacred design, a place for of spiritual significance. So the one that most readily comes to mind for me is in High Park. There is a labyrinth. And if you go and walk it, you will discover that it is not a maze. There is no possible way to get lost. You just kind of walk in this spiral-like formation, this track that leads you to the middle. And you may find, to your surprise, that you are a little bit more calm.
Oh, wow. Okay. If you're in Toronto, go to High Park. If you're not from Toronto, come to Toronto, go to High Park and go in the labyrinth. I'm going to try to remember this one because I love this one. I'm going to think of a labyrinth like a snail shell, like it just goes around and round and round. I don't even know if that's exactly what a snail shell did, but that's how I'm going to remember this one.
No, so they do, they vary in design, but that's kind of a classic starting point, is it's just going to be a spiral-like formation, but often it will change direction on you. So you'll be going, you know, round and round and round in one direction, and all of a sudden round and round in another, and somehow inevitably it leads you to the center. Now, here's what complicates things.
I've got it clear in my head now.
So many listeners will be familiar with the ancient Greek myth of the labyrinth and the labyrinth and the Minotaur, in which this hero named Theseus goes into the labyrinth to slay the Minotaur. But in order that he doesn't get lost, he leaves behind him string, a length of string, so that he can find his way out. But if it's a true labyrinth, he wouldn't need the string. Mm-hmm. If it's unicursal.
This is not Hansel and Gretel, right? Breadcrumbs.
Exactly.
That's a maze.
That's exactly.
Yes.
That is a good counterexample. Exactly. So then in that case, it really is a maze, even though we call it a labyrinth. So the word, this is a bit like envy and jealousy again, where the word maze only refers to the game. The word labyrinth is a bit either or. Just the way envy only refers to envy, jealousy means jealousy or envy.
I'm just telling our listeners out there that they've got it for now, but if you need to go back to learn these distinctions, to lock them in your brain, you can do so. We always post our stories at cbc.ca/Sunday, because I'm going to need to go back to get these ones correctly. And jealousy can be envy, but envy can't be jealousy, or else the other way around. I don't know. I'll figure it out. Okay, at the very end of this book, and I mean the very, very end of your book, Eli, after the index, after the acknowledgements, like no one reads that far in most books, just before the back cover, you snuck in one last fine distinction.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to tell us what it is?
That's right. That's the distinction between copyright and trademark. And I thought it would just be a fun little Easter egg to bury at the back of the book. Easter egg or hidden gem. I don't know. That's another fine distinction I neglected to include. But yeah, I just thought that, you know, many books will often have their copyright and trademark information at the back of the book, although just as often, if not more often, at the front of the book. But it's a place where people tend to gloss over because they go, oh, well, I don't know what any of that is. So I just thought it'd be fun to have one last one there and explaining the difference between.
Don't leave us hanging.
Copyright protects an author's original work, whether it's lyrics or a movie script or the text in a book or the images in a book for that matter, whereas trademark protects a brand's identifying marks. So to give an example, the text of the book and the images in the book are copyright, whereas the little logo that you'll find on the spine of the book, the publisher's Union Square, their logo, is trademark.
I love this. This is so fun. Thank you for putting it down on paper. And as you say, these have high stakes and sometimes low stakes, but it's important for us to get better at all this stuff. Appreciate it and appreciate your book. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much.
Love that. Eli Bernstein is a Canadian humor writer and the author of The Dictionary of Fine Distinctions. Now, I know all of you in Radioland and CBC lovers have thoughts on this topic, or is it subject? I don't know. Anyway, what is a common distinction that drives you mad when someone else gets it wrong, and why is it important to know the difference between those terms? My fave, I'll offer one up, is the difference between accurate and precise. You share your finest distinctions with us by sending us an email to sunday@cbc.ca, and we're going to feature some of the most passionate ones here next Sunday.
The climate is changing, so are we. I'm Laura Lynch, and I host What on Earth? That's CBC's Climate Solutions podcast. Twice a week, we take you around the world to find the people who are trying to build a better future for all of us. We explore Indigenous science, new technologies. We talk openly about mental health and climate anxiety. We also take your smart questions all the time. Come find What on Earth wherever you get your podcasts.
Today marks 6 months since Hamas attacked Israel, killing about 1,200 people and taking 250 others hostage, many of whom are still being held in Gaza. Since that day, Israel's responding offensive has killed more than 33,000 people in Gaza, left tens of thousands injured and hundreds of thousands homeless, according to the Hamas-run health ministry. This past week, much of the focus in this war turned to humanitarian aid and the people who deliver it after Israeli strikes killed seven members of the NGO World Central Kitchen. They were among the roughly 200 aid workers the UN says have been killed since this conflict began, many of them killed while carrying out their work. Israel has since called last Monday's attack a grave mistake. It has also fired two senior military officials following an internal investigation, but there are calls and growing ones for an independent inquiry. Abby Stoddard is a former aid worker and a partner at the independent research organization Humanitarian Outcomes. Abby, hello to you.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being with us. World Central Kitchen, humanitarian organization that is widely respected around the world. As someone who has been part of the humanitarian aid world, to what extent were you surprised when you heard about the killing of these seven people, given the context in which they were working in?
Well, it really was heartbreaking. You know, I'd been watching with a lot of admiration as World Central Kitchen took what I think was a very proactive and innovative approach to increasing access to humanitarian aid in Gaza. But I can't say it was surprising. Gaza was already the deadliest context for aid workers that we've seen in decades of tracking this information in the aid worker security database.
Let's talk about kind of what has happened since that attack. A couple of days after it, United States President Joe Biden personally told Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that American policy towards Israel would depend on what steps Israel takes in terms of more aid getting in. And so then shortly after those two spoke, Israel announced that it would be opening two or three corridors to get aid into Gaza. There are more than a million people in Gaza who are experiencing catastrophic food insecurity and facing the risk of famine. This is according to the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification. So, Abby, what difference do you think opening a couple of land routes might make in terms of getting aid to those who so desperately need it?
Well, it will make a lot of difference. It is a crucial step. Another border crossing in the north is critically needed, as there's been virtually no aid reaching the northern governorates. We did a survey of Palestinians in Gaza, and less than a quarter of people in the north had received any sort of aid at any time during the conflict. So it's an important step, but nowhere near sufficient. People are already dying of starvation.
And of course, if you open routes in, you have to get the actual aid in, right? It's one thing to open routes, another to get those trucks moving in. And as we've been looking at the satellite data coming out of Gaza, an analysis of that data has found that like so much infrastructure in Gaza has been destroyed. Roads are impassable where there are roads. So how do those sort of things factor into the challenges of getting aid distributed in that kind of environment?
Well, the logistical challenges, as you say, are huge. The roads, the destruction makes it difficult to travel around, but also fuel is short because it's one of the restricted items coming in. And really, more than these logistical problems, there's an insecurity problem of getting trucks coming in, because if they stop for more than 10 minutes, they tend to be emptied, especially at the border crossings where there's been a complete breakdown of law and order, both criminal gangs and just groups of desperate people needing this food.
The other thing that a lot of people are talking about, should more aid get in, is about UNRWA, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency. Historically, the largest aid provider in Gaza, it has come under a lot of scrutiny during this war after Israel alleged a dozen of its contractors took part in the October 7th attacks. And there is this UN investigation which is continuing into those claims. Some countries, including Canada, had paused, then resumed funding. But the reality is that UNRWA's biggest donor, the United States, continues to cut off funding. How much has this affected UNRWA's ability to operate in Gaza, and what's been the broader impact on overall aid distribution as a result?
From what I understand, they are still managing to keep around 3,000 emergency staff working to provide aid. But as you say, UNRWA has always been the linchpin for providing humanitarian aid and basic services to Gazans. They have more staff than any of the other aid agencies combined. They have the facilities and logistical infrastructure, et cetera, which are all critical. And this is why the international NGOs signed a joint public statement saying that UNRWA is indispensable to the current effort. So the hope right now is that whatever's going to become of UNRWA in the future, that other donor governments will step up and fill the gap left by the US, UK, and other countries defunding.
I mentioned in our introduction that the UN estimates about 200 humanitarian aid workers have been killed in Gaza during the past 6 months. And you said that you've done surveys in Gaza, and you've, of course, looked at the number of people killed. How does that casualty, 200 humanitarian aid workers killed in a six-month period, stack up to other conflicts we've seen?
Well, as of yesterday, with some additional reports, our database has recorded 215 aid workers killed in Gaza. So this is a whole other level than anything we've seen before. It's a higher number than we would typically see in a whole year across the entire world. And it's just one context in 6 months.
Why is this war in particular so dangerous for aid workers?
Well, partly it's reflective of just the massive overall civilian death toll, which comes from having a major military campaign fought with airstrikes and heavy weaponry in a very small place, including dense urban environments with an essentially captive population. So aid workers there are affected by collateral violence as well as direct threats, if any, to their security.
I'm sure you talk to a lot of people in the broader aid worker community. For those who you know and who want to or have been working in Gaza, and given what happened last Monday, what would you say the mood is sort of like?
There's really a crisis of confidence in deconfliction, and a loss of trust, which has been happening in other areas too, in Ukraine and Syria as well, but it's taken a real hit in Gaza. Ideally, the way this should work is that when humanitarians share their coordinates and their planned movements, that the military actors will give assurances that those sites and those vehicles will not be struck and that all steps will be taken, including a pause in action to avoid this kind of collateral damage. And what we've seen instead is that humanitarians are giving scrupulous information repeatedly and not even getting firm acknowledgement that from the military that they will be safe. It has some feeling very much like this is deliberate. There's no direct evidence that they can point to, but with numerous close calls and directly after deconflicting a site, it will be hit, people will be killed. There's just, as I say, a real crisis in faith in the process.
Gaza, of course, is unique in many ways. The size of it, the fact that it is closed on all sides and needs Israeli permission for borders to be open and so on and so forth. How does the danger within that sort of description of humanitarian work differ during the past 6 months of this Israel-Hamas war? And say more, I don't know, traditional war, I'm thinking of like Russia-Ukraine.
Well, the difference between Gaza and Ukraine is that Ukraine is a very large country, right? And the battle lines in Ukraine, where most of the fighting is happening, are relatively stable. So it is possible for aid organizations to mitigate the risk to their staff by keeping them sort of outside of artillery range, apart from, you know, armored convoys when they go in. And then for the rocket and drone attacks, they can use the advanced warning system and sheltering drills to keep staff relatively safe. In Gaza, by contrast, as you're always hearing, there's no place to go that's safe where you're not in the zone of danger.
You've been studying the dangers faced by humanitarian aid workers in war zones for years. You yourself have been a humanitarian aid worker. Broadly speaking, over the years and decades, is doing this kind of work more dangerous?
Yes, unfortunately, despite great strides in security risk management across the humanitarian sector, you're still seeing overall fatalities and attacks rising. And we know that more aid workers died from deliberate violence than any other job-related cause, some years kind of rivaling militaries and uniformed peacekeeping troops.
And so, Abby, like in this increasingly dangerous environment for humanitarian aid workers, as you described, during wartime and in war zones, what do you think should and can be done to make the environment in which aid workers work more safe?
Well, really, what will make it more safe is a cessation of fighting, to state the obvious. As they say, there are no humanitarian solutions to humanitarian problems, only political ones. So you need the political will from governments to put pressure on conflict parties to respect international humanitarian law and hold them accountable when these things happen. So longer humanitarian pauses and safe corridors would be a start. In terms of what...
Go ahead.
I was going to say, in terms of what aid organizations can do, they need to really develop and push strategies for engaging with states and conflict parties to address the trust issues with deconfliction, et cetera.
Abby, appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Abby Stoddard is a partner at Humanitarian Outcomes, which researches risks to humanitarian workers in conflict zones. Okay, so hold on a sec. I'm just going to do a quick inventory here. I have my pen and paper, which I always do. So check, calm, focused mind, check. Eye of the tiger, checkish. I guess it all means that I, and I hope you are, ready to play That's Puzzling.
Supposing you find the answer to who did he do the things to do? What is it that has to be done as a puzzling song?
Once a month, I take on one of my CBC colleagues and a super smart listener in a series of brain games. My colleagues are also super smart. The listeners and colleagues have been on a hot streak lately, and by lately, I mean a very, very, I'm going to have to keep adding varies to this, long time. I will admit, am I going to admit this? I'm starting to lose a bit of confidence, definitely have lost my cockiness for now. But will our unique solar alignment bring me some cosmic luck on the eve of this solar eclipse? Let's meet the man who comes up with our puzzle, the man who lately has been the moon blocking my sun. I urge you not to look directly at him without special glasses. I don't know what special glasses would do anyway, but hey, here's Peter Brown.
Pia, I plan to give you questions so dazzling that you would be wise to use a pinhole camera or welder's glasses to look at them directly.
I have one of those two things.
Excellent. Pia, I think with the stars, or at least the moon and the star aligning, I have a feeling that this is your week. That's my feeling. Let's see how long it lasts.
Mm-hmm. You've been saying that for weeks, and it hasn't been my week. So I'm going in with low confidence this time.
I have grit in my belief in you, Pia. But maybe you'll disappoint me. Let's find out. Let's meet Pia's opponents this month. First, with Pia in our Toronto studio, she hosts Just Asking, the show that answers all your questions about reward loyalty programs, fake photos, and breaking up with friends. It's Saroja Coelho. Hello, Saroja.
Hi. Hello, hello.
Saroja, I have a question for you.
Ask me.
When I phone a bank or an airline, I sit on hold for 90 minutes. How shocked are your listeners that you actually take their calls?
We have such a direct connection with folks. I do think that some get a bit surprised to be on the air. But what I'm actually really amazed by is that people find their feet really quickly. They're surprised to be on the air with us live, and suddenly everybody's listening to them. But there's not a lot of stage fright. People really get into it. They like having that immediate connection with folks that they've been hearing on the radio. And the questions are really smart. I got to say, sometimes they stump us with some really good, insightful ones. So it's a lot of fun.
Well, Saroja, I wish you a Just Asking style welcome and wish you good luck. Our final competitor today won their spot in today's game by entering our listener challenge. We asked you to invent a word to describe the act of yelling at the radio when they mispronounce the name of your city or province. Our winning word is...
Municipalling.
Municipalling is splendid. That is our winning listener, Peter McGregor in Vancouver. Vancouver. Hello, Peter.
Good morning, sir.
Have you had a place you lived mispronounced on the radio?
I have heard this one more times than I can count. A little bit east of Vancouver, there's a city called New Westminster. It was also for many years referred to as a royal city because of its name and because it was named by Queen Victoria. But I have never heard it referred to as a godly city, so I don't know where Minister came from, but people keep doing it.
Oh, New Westminster.
I'm always interested how Vancouverites say Vancouver, because you are one of the ones that says Vancouver. There's more of a G after that N. And then there's lots of people who say Vancouver. I'm a big fan of Vancouver, but since you live there, you can call your city whatever you want. Just saying.
Well, so many people are calling it No Funcouver these days. So.
Peter McGregor, what kind of puzzles are you into? Do you do the cryptics? Do you do Wordle? What sort of puzzles are you into?
Well, my number one first thing every day is definitely the cryptic, and then I head over for the New York Times and I do the connections and the pentagram and any other crossword that comes across my way, New York Times faithfully.
I just heard a noise from Pia that I think meant uh-oh.
Yeah. If someone plays crosswords, especially first, crosswords are a good practice for that's puzzling.
All right. So just to check in, Pia is struggling to retain her confidence. Saroja is welcome and into it so far. And Peter has been training every moment of his life for this moment.
I'm undefeated so far.
Yes, he brings in, putting his undefeated Sterling record on the line. Saroja, Peter, and Pia, let's play That's Puzzling. As always, we begin today with a definition challenge. I'm going to give you a word and three possible definitions. One of those definitions is real. Two I've made up. Your challenge is to spot the correct definition. Again, one real, two fake. Spot the real one for 1 point. Your word today is grom, G-R-O-M, grom. Which of the following is a real definition of grom? Is it a very young skateboarder? Is it the rubber knob at the end of a cane or crutch? Or is it a device that measures airflow in a jet engine? So it's the young skateboarder, the knob on the cane, or the jet engine device. Pia, which do you think is the real one?
You always come to me first on the definition one. And I'm like, I don't know. That's what I'm going to say. I heard you say grom. I thought gram and prom. So I don't know where that's going to get me.
Prom too.
Yeah, definitely. Prom. I guess we're heading to that time of year that the kids are having the proms. I don't think it's a very young skateboarder. I don't know why. Like, I'm going to have no reasoning as I lead up to tell you which one I think it is.
Okay.
I just don't think it's a very young skateboarder. Airflow in a jet engine, I kind of want to pick that one, but I feel like you just it's a measurement and gram is a measurement. I'm always trying to think of how you think of these things. And when I say this out loud, Peter, I always get it wrong. But I'm going to go with I don't want to go with the rubber knob. Is that really called a grom? Like putting the grom on your cane? I'm going with the cane. I'm going with the rubber knob. I don't know why. It's wrong.
All right.
I'm just going choosing.
Pia, you forced me to pick very specific topics because there was one that was a specific English one and you knew it because you heard it in a pub in Manchester.
Yes.
So I always have to ask myself, what would not have been heard in a pub in Northern England? So,
People generally don't talk about canes or jet engines in pubs, or at least pubs I visit. So maybe I should have chosen the skateboard. I don't know.
Saroja, what do you think?
I am really feeling the jet engine one. I'm not sure why. It just feels like something I could imagine a mechanic, getting into the guts of the jet and asking them, we got to measure the grom. The grom's broken. The grom's not
so
functioning.
Convincing.
Yeah, I feel very good about this one.
Okay.
I'm going all in, all cards on the table for jet engine.
All right.
For airflow, what did you say? Airflow measuring.
It's a device that measures the airflow into a jet engine. Yeah.
All right, yeah.
All right.
I like that one.
Peter, what do you think?
Well, I was thinking that grom was very close to grommet, which made me sort of gravitate towards the cane, but then I thought, that's probably a diversion. That's too easy. And jet airflow, it just doesn't sound an official enough or a scientific enough term. So by default, I'm going with a skateboarder. Sounds grunt, grom, grungy, whatever, grunt, close enough.
The correct answer is the young skateboarder.
Whoa!
It is a term from extreme sports. It can be applied to young surfers and young skateboarders, young snowboarders.
Whoa.
It's thought to be derived either from an old Navy term for a young sailor or actually from grommet. Peter is on the board. As I say that, I think, don't lose confidence, Pia. Don't lose confidence. Peter.
Saroja, I'm going to ask you to do something. Just describe the look of me right now. It's just my shoulders are, I'm basically on the floor. Just
there
crying.
Is such a gray cloud that has passed over Pia that it's going to be hard for her to see the solar eclipse. This is the problem we have now.
Definitions is a category I usually do badly in, so.
Just taking us out, even with the description, just taking us out. It's all right. Okay, I got to take off my jacket. I got to do some push-ups. I'm ready.
There are a lot of points still on the board. We're going to move to our second round, and this is a game we call Plus One. Players, we are looking for two words. Those words will be identical, except the second word has one added letter. That's the plus one. So, for instance, if I asked you to take a word that means be victorious and add a letter to make a word for identical sibling, be victorious and identical sibling by adding a letter, the correct answer would be win and twin. Win is be victorious, twin is identical sibling, and the added letter is the T at the front of twin. That added letter could go at the beginning of the word or the end or anywhere in between, and I will offer the first person a hint for either the first or the second part of the answer. Here we go. These are worth 2 points. Saroja, we're going to start with you.
Oh.
Take a word that means a pile of snow and add one letter to make a word for empty. And you can have a hint about either of those things. Pile of snow, add a letter, empty.
Oh, my goodness. I was feeling very confident. You know, I've spent much of my life in Quebec, so I feel under a great deal of pressure to represent. But a pile of snow, a specific word for a pile of snow. And sorry, the second word is?
Is empty.
Empty.
And that's a noun, by the way. It's... Or I guess it's an adjective, but it's not the verb to empty. It's something that
okay,
is
let me
empty.
Think here. A dump of snow, a pile of snow, a mountain of snow, a what else can there be of snow specific? Something for empty?
Yes.
Okay, drift, a snow.
Tell me if you'd like a hint.
Yeah, give me a snow hint.
It also means the land beside a river.
The bank and something for empty. Ben, you're looking confident, Pia. This is very intimidating. Your face says I know things that you don't know.
I know this. Those are the lyrics to what he's humming. Saroja, I'm going to have to give you a few more seconds, and that's going to be it.
I understand. Yep. Let me just think about this for a second. Something empty sounds something like ank, bank, brank, blank, 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 blank. My face was blank. My brain was blank. The word is blank. Oh, I'm in a literal sweat.
The hint for the second one is you are currently drawing one of these. Bank is a pile of snow. Blank is empty, as in a blank space on a wall or drawing a blank.
You should see her. It's like she had the adrenaline rush, and now she's just like taking it all in.
I enjoyed Peter's lyric la song, which was I know this.
Yeah. Thank goodness. I was very, you know, my mom is a teacher. I was not going to be able to go home.
Peter, we turn to you. Hummer of tunes, knower of puzzles. Your challenge is to take a word for just, and add a letter to get a word for style. And again, I can clarify either of those with a hint. Just, and get a word for style.
Just. Yeah, give me a little information about just.
Just as in equitable or even-handed.
All right. I've got a fair idea about this. So fair at an Ellen Flair.
That's right. That is correct. And again, everyone had it, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Just is fair and style is flair. Peter has three.
So that means I'm winning.
You are winning. Yes, hang on to this. And keep saying it out loud. And now, Pia, it turns to you.
Uh-huh.
I would encourage you to become 30% more optimistic.
I got the last two. And that counts for absolutely 0% when it's not your turn. Yeah.
Your challenge, Pia, is to take a word for rent, add a letter to get a word for make happy.
Make happy. Well, if I get this right, I'll be make happy. Okay, to rent. Rent. If I pay the rent, oh gosh, this is hard for me. Rent, because rent is throwing me. Is make happy going to be? Encourage? Oh, shoot. Saroja.
It's definitely hard. It's definitely hard.
Hints are available, Pia.
Yeah, I'm going to. It's definitely. You know what she just said without saying the quiet part out loud? It's definitely hard, but I have it. So my opponents have it and I don't, which just makes this so much worse. Okay. Let's take a hint. Now, which side do I take a hint on? Because I feel like a rent might be the better place to take it.
I think so too.
Okay.
Another term for a rental contract.
A rental
contract. You sign
a... lease. Please. To lease and please?
Yes, Pia.
Oh, hard because they don't even rhyme.
Yeah, that's hard.
I do look for ones where the sound of one of the consonants or vowels changes.
Except
Pia.
You didn't for my other opponents, and so I want an extra point.
I grant, Pia, I grant ye a moral victory.
Who, that wasn't a moral victory. That's just a victory.
I give you a non-point related victory.
What do you mean?
So,
oh, in addition to the real points.
Oh.
That's right, yeah.
Okay. Ooh.
We turn now to our final round, and we're going to stick with plus one. And Saroja, this first question is for you. The score is currently, you have two, Pia has two, Peter has three. It's all to play for.
Okay.
Take a word for two people singing, add a letter to get a type of bedding.
Duet and duvet.
Very quick.
Easy. Yeah, easy. Saroja has perma smile on her face, right? And she's like daydreaming.
I'm
she's
just
looking into
so
the
happy.
Sun.
Whatever else happens, Saroja, you got 4 points. You got the second round right.
You know, part of the reason I'm so happy, I was like anxious about this. I was worried. You cannot prepare for this. It's like, what do I read bathroom readers? Like, how do I get flexed for this?
Yes, bathroom readers.
Pia, here's your second round question. Ready?
Mm.
Your challenge is to take a word for stop.
Stop.
S-T-O-P. Stop.
Yep.
Add a letter to get wrinkle.
Wrinkle.
Stop and wrinkle.
Got it.
Peter McGregor, I have to be nice to guests. It's part of the contractual deal at the CBC. But if you and I were playing an off-air life, I might say something to you right when you did that. Just saying. Okay. Halt and wrinkle. Now, I don't want a clue yet, but I don't know if this is asking for a clue without asking for a clue. Am I using these as verbs or nouns? Is that asking for a clue? I think so.
Okay. I will tell you that the second one could be either. The first one is a verb.
Okay. So I'm going to start with stop and just think this through.
Yeah.
Arrest. To stop something is to halt. That's my Rolodex of synonym sound. Stop, arrest, halt. When you stop, a door stop, like a noun. A stop is a, I don't know. Okay, wrinkle. You said either verb or a noun. A wrinkle is, oh gosh, to wrinkle, crease.
Keep going.
Crease, creased, oh boy. Is crease right? That was a Peter Brown sound.
Which I think what I said was keep going. Can you take a letter off of crease to make stop?
Well, this is plus one. Oh, because I've already added the plus one because I'm doing wrinkle
yes.
first. Oh, okay. Cease. I was
well
like,
done.
You know what I was doing there? I was taking off the E at the end and
yes.
I was like, well,
yes.
that's crass.
Yes.
And then if I take the C off at the beginning, that's Rhea. Anyway. Oh, boy. Crease
Bravo.
Is for wrinkle.
That was tough.
See, so I played minus one there.
I that's why I nudged you gently backwards. Pia, you got 4 points.
Yay! Peter McGregor, we're friends again.
I think the host is playing favorites. A little bit too much help there for her.
Okay.
Well, Peter, given that I'm about to offer you a question, I would not be piping up so much with criticizing of the quizmaster.
That's intimidation.
Exactly. Pia has 4. Saroja has 4. Peter has 3. Whoever gets this one will win the game. Peter, take a moment to feel the pressure of this. Take a word for a tree and add one letter to get well-liked. A tree, add a letter to get well-liked.
Oh.
I'm a little nervous now.
A tree. And... So my question would be about the first word, a tree. Is that to mean a particular type of tree, like poplar, alder, etc.?
It's a kind of tree with silver gray bark.
And well liked.
That sounds like a description of me. Someone with silver gray.
And well liked.
Yeah, fair.
Silver tree. Silver birch, land of the beaver, where new, no, not birch, well liked. Tree, gone. It's popping for me now. I think we got a popular poplar.
There it is. Peter, you put me in a terrible position because you said, oh, is it something like a poplar or a birch? And I went, yeah, it's something very like that. The final score could not have been closer. Peter, by guessing the young skateboarder, triumphed in the definition round. Everybody else got all their questions right. Pia and Saroja both got 4. Peter got 5. Peter in Vancouver is our winner. Congratulations.
Bravo. That was fun.
Thank you. I am humbled by my competition was excellent. I have but one small request. Since I did officially win, I would really love a certificate so I can put it in my trophy case alongside my CBC early edition coffee mug and license plate holder.
You get a trophy and it's a Sunday Magazine coffee cup or notebook. I will just say Peter really killed this game because he is the kind of player who will tell you when he knows things, and he certainly did that. And you got every single one right, right, Peter?
Yeah, but P and Saroja also got their plus ones right on both rounds.
But we got that definition. A grom.
A grom!
Oh, the young people.
Well, at least the young people are confused at home going, what is a notebook? Saroja, it's lovely to meet you, and I look forward to hearing more questions answered.
Thank you. This has been so much fun. I didn't need to spend nearly as much time being anxious about it. It was absolutely hilarious and so much fun. Congratulations, Peter, in Vancouver. Well done.
Thank you very much. And you made me feel very much at ease. I was nervous going in, but it turned out well.
Peter McGregor, I don't know if you live with someone else, but you could have them hold the early edition mug and you hold your soon-to-be-received Sunday Magazine mug. And on behalf of us, cheers yourself for your victory.
Sounds like a plan.
Well, Pia, I wave a fond goodbye to your well-liked gray bark. And I thank Saroja and Peter in Vancouver for playing. And that was a very entertaining and competitive round of That's Puzzling.
Thank you, everyone. We will be back, of course, next month with a new round of That's Puzzling, and you could be our next listener contestant. To put your name in contention, we invite you to take on our challenge. We want you to invent a word for something unusual that is happening now. We are in that rare season when Canada's professional hockey, basketball, and baseball teams are all playing at the same time, not all playing as well as the others, but that's another story. So it is a sports eclipse, and we're challenging you to come up with a name for that. Send us your term, your word, by emailing sunday@cbc.ca. Put That's Puzzling in the subject line and include your phone number. You have until the end of next Sunday, which is April 14th, to submit the word you invent. The winner will play next month and win the ultimate prize, a Sunday Magazine coffee mug, or possibly the other ultimate prize, a Sunday Magazine notebook. Which prize will eclipse the other? Okay, let's turn to that other eclipse that will have many Canadians looking to the sky tomorrow with safety glasses on. Please, and of course, a total solar eclipse will grace a swath of Ontario, Quebec, and Atlantic Canada with a partial eclipse on offer for the rest of the country. The phenomenon will only last a few short minutes, but there's still plenty of excitement for that moment when things will go dark. And there's a whole lot of meaning behind this treat for the eyes. Bob McDonald is the host of the CBC Radio's Quirks and Quarks and a star science journalist. Like that? You like that?
I like that. Yeah.
Star journalist and the star science journalist. So scale of 1 to 10, how excited are you about tomorrow's eclipse?
Oh, I'm number 10. They're all great. They're all great. I've seen 6 eclipses. This one's lucky number 7. I'm going to be in Kingston, Ontario, which is on the path of totality, and I'm really looking forward to it because every eclipse is unique, and they are a wonderful experience. There's a saying among eclipse chasers, until you've seen a total solar eclipse, you have not seen an eclipse. So if you've only seen a partial where just a little bit of the sun is covered, that's not the same as the total effect. It's just a whole environment thing. No video or picture can capture it. You have to be there. And I've been all over the world chasing them, and it's just a great, great experience.
Okay, wait, you've seen 6 other total solar eclipses in your life?
Oh, yeah.
Where?
Well, my first was in 1977 on a cruise ship 1,200 nautical miles off the coast of Mexico in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, where the path of totality went by. I was on the deck of a ship for that one. Then in 1980, I went to Africa, to Tanzania and the plains of the Serengeti, and saw one at the base of Mount Kilimanjaro. Then I went to Indonesia and saw one on the island of Jakarta.
Wow.
I saw one in 1979 in northern Ontario, in the small town of Red Lake, Ontario. That was a Canadian one. Unfortunately, that one was clouded out, but it was still an interesting experience to, even though we couldn't see the sun, the daylight just suddenly disappeared for a couple of minutes and then came back on again. It was like, well, what the heck was that all about? And I saw one in Hawaii in 1991 on the island, the big island of Hawaii. And in 2017, saw one in Casper, Wyoming, the one that went across the United States.
So yes.
They're all great.
Okay, so it's what I'm hearing from you is not seeing one, seeing them all. Like, I only need to see this one. So each one is kind of different or unique.
Yes, because you're in a different environment. They happen in different parts of the world every time. I mean, eclipses happen almost every year or every 2 years, but they're in different parts of the planet. So you got to go there, and you got to be right in that narrow path of totality, which is not very wide. Sometimes it's only about 20 kilometers wide, and that's where the moon covers the sun exactly. And it's an entire change of environment. It's not just the sun itself. It slowly starts to get dark. The sky turns kind of a gray, and colors disappear, and it's like a weird light that you're in, like something's weird's going on here. And then just before totality, when the sun gets reduced down to a little thin sliver of light, it's like the lights in a theater just before a movie. It drops that quickly. It just suddenly, wow, this is crazy. And then the sun turns into this incredible ring with a silver glow around it. That is the sun's corona, its atmosphere. And I can only describe it as, think of finely polished silver, but it's cat's fur. Okay, there's no definable edge to it, like cat's fur. It just kind of sticks out in all directions, and that's the corona. And on a couple of them, I've even seen tongues, red, blood-red tongues sticking out into that corona from the sun, and these are huge eruptions that are happening on the sun. You can see them with the visible eye. And then the thing that most people don't realize is that planets show up as well, especially Venus and Mercury, which are very close to the sun. They appear as diamonds. Along with the sun. So in one case, I saw them on either side of the sun, and this time that's going to happen. We got Jupiter, Venus, and I think Saturn are going to be up at that time. And it looks like a necklace across the sky. You got these diamonds and then this pendant in the middle, which is the sun itself. And the sky doesn't go black. It's a cobalt blue overhead. But as you look around the horizon, it's a gold sunset gold, but it's all the way around you because you're in this small shadow. So it's amazing. The temperature drops. People start screaming and yelling and hooting and hollering. And it's really amazing. And it's a humbling experience because something big is happening and you have no power over it at all. You can't stop it. It's the cosmos doing something, and you realize that we humans are pretty puny compared to this stuff.
Okay, so your enthusiasm is very convincing, Bob, but I'm gonna tell you, my husband, who's very stoked about this thing, is taking our kids and going to Belleville, which is also in the path of totality.
Yep, good stuff.
And he said to me the other day, are you going to come? And I said, nah, I'll just go to the park across the street and watch it in Toronto, because we get the partial eclipse, which is what most of Canada is going to get.
Yeah.
Am I, all those things you just described, the silvery cat tails, the cat fur, the seeing of the planets, if I'm in partial eclipse zone, which again is tens of millions of Canadians, what are we getting?
Well, you get almost all of that up until the totality part. So you'll see the sun get reduced to a very thin sliver. You'll notice that it feels like you're going colorblind because colors seem to disappear. And you get this effect where the sun is almost a point of light and all the shadows become very sharp. And if there's a tree with leaves on it or they make shadows on the ground that are little crescents, that like they project like pinhole cameras to make crescents on the ground, which is the sun. But you don't get totality, and you cannot look at the sun directly with your eyes. That's the rest of Canada. You have to have protective equipment, either eclipse glasses or project it some way, but you cannot look at it. And that's where this myth that you could go blind, during an eclipse. If it's a partial eclipse, and even in totality, during the partial phases, you cannot look at the sun. It's only during those few minutes when the moon completely covers the sun during totality that you can look at it with the naked eye. So you got to be in the right place at the right time.
Okay, we're going to talk more about what the moon and the sun do. But before we get there, I love your description of all of this. There's also a ton of misinformation out there about what happens during an eclipse. You know, you've heard all these quote unquote theories. Cell phones will stop working. Birds will fall from the sky. they're ludicrous. Some of them, they go beyond that. What does happen on Earth over these few minutes? I just said our cell phones aren't going to die. Someone said, I pick my kid up during the eclipse from daycare? I said, I don't know. So help them out.
Of course you can. You can get on with life. If you don't look up, you probably wouldn't even know what was happening if you're in the partial phases. So your cell phone would be fine. But during totality, the temperature does drop because you're in a shadow and it gets cool by up to, 5 or 10 degrees. And that's also part of the experience. Like you get chilled, like, ooh, this is big. Something's going on here. And birds do react to it, but they don't fall from the sky. They take off. Because they're confused. What's going on? How come it's dark in the middle of the day? And they just start buzzing around. They fly all over the place. And that is one of the things that does happen. So animals are not expecting it. And it's unusual to go dark in the middle of the day. So you do see some unusual activity.
Yeah. Clearly, we still have things to learn. But we've come a long way in human history.
Certainly have.
There have always been eclipses. Like, back thousands of years ago, what were some of the going theories? Because they didn't have the scientific knowledge that we, of course, have today. There's always been mysteries about celestial and astronomical things. But what did they think was happening?
Well, what I find interesting is that eclipses have been around for millions of years, longer than humans have been around.
Sure.
So our ancient ancestors, the Australopithecines, Neanderthals, Cro-Magnons, they saw them. And what did they think? I have no idea. Maybe there was an Einstein back then who figured it all out, but he couldn't tell anybody because they didn't have writing. I don't know. But we know the earliest recordings of an eclipse goes back to ancient China about 4,000 years ago. And there's records there of the sun being covered by the moon or the sun, something not right. And we know that in early times, they were thought of as omens, either good or bad.
Mm.
And there was an interesting case in Greece in 585 BC, or what we now call BCE. And there was a war that was going on between the Lydians and the Medes. And this war had been going on for 6 years. And one day they were going to battle and a solar eclipse happened. It caught everybody by surprise. They thought it was an omen. They put down their weapons and negotiated peace.
Oh, wow.
It ended the war. They thought, okay, the gods are talking to us. This isn't right. We got to end this.
Yeah.
And it ended the war. It's really quite astounding.
Wow.
In 1922, there was a Canadian expedition led by Dr. Chant from the University of Toronto, and he went to Australia to see an eclipse of the sun to prove Einstein's theory of relativity. Einstein predicted that gravity can bend light. It can actually cause it to curve. And so they went to this expedition to see stars that are behind the sun, see whether or not they would change their position during totality.
Hmm.
And they did. They proved it. The stars seemed to shift their position because their light was bent by the gravity of the sun. But you can only see that during an eclipse when the sky goes dark, where you can see past the sun to a star. And so that was, again, Canadian contribution proving that Einstein was right. So eclipses have had, roles all along, from scientific to stopping wars to mythological to who knows what.
Yeah, who knows what.
Yeah.
So tomorrow, again, millions of Canadians are going to get this partial eclipse. Some are going to get this total eclipse.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to stand there. And we're going to have our safety goggles on. And we're going to look at this thing. And as you say, it's not just looking at it. It's the entire experience, that sort of stillness, that weirdness. It's all going to happen. There are still people after hearing us blabber, like, I'm going to stay inside. I want them to go outside. But what do you hope non-science nerds and just non-science people can take away from a moment like this? As you say, the Earth is covered mostly with water. These happen all the time, but we don't get in North America a view like this very often.
Well, I'll tell you, most of the eclipses that I've seen, five of them, I've been with science geeks. And we all knew what was going to happen. We know about the different phases. We knew the timing of it. There are these things called Bailey's beads. And then there's the, you know, the diamond ring and all of these things. We're going, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, we still get excited about it and it's still fun. But the last one that I saw in 2017 in Wyoming was the first time that I was among just the general public. And the small town called Casper had a festival for 3 days. And it was a street festival. And it was party, you know, you could have a beer in the street. There was music. There were vendors selling stuff, food. It was really great. But on the morning of the eclipse, everything went quiet. And everyone was just sitting around knowing something was coming, but they didn't know what. And it was eerie. Everyone was just quiet. And then when totality happened, of course, everyone started screaming and yelling and hooping and hollering, go, whoa, this is really amazing, really great. But then after it was over, everyone went quiet again. And it was almost like we'd had this like religious experience or some cosmic experience just went by that was humbling, that we had no control over, that the universe is so much more powerful than we are. And it's kind of, that's what it does to you. It lets you know that we humans are not as powerful as we think we are. There are forces out there far greater than us. And even just a simple shadow passing over the earth changes everything. And we have no control over it whatsoever. So there's a profound sense of your place in the cosmos, at least for me, after you experience one of these things, after you experience totality.
Yeah, we have so few communal experiences anymore. Yeah. And so here's one. I'm really looking forward to it, and more so after hearing from you. Appreciate you as always. Thanks, Bob.
Bye-bye.
Bob McDonald is the host of Quirks and Quarks, which you can catch Saturdays at noon here on CBC Radio and anytime on the CBC Listen app. And that's it for this week here on the Sunday Magazine. Our producers are Levi Garber, Brianna Goss, Andrea Huang, Adam Killick, Pete Mitten, and Aronde Williams. We had additional help this week from audio technicians Marco Luciano and Sam McNulty, as well as studio director Susan McReynolds. Our senior producer is Howard Goldenthal. Our executive producer is Brian Colton. I'm Pia Chattopadhyay. Thank you for lending us your ear. Enjoy the eclipse. Till next Sunday.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.